I am Planta on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. I didn't know much about Radiohead, but it was fascinating to read about the music group, their music, their influences, and their impact in a new book by Phil Rose, who joins me now. Radiohead, Music for a Global Future, looks at the cultural phenomena as well as the members of the group and their engagement not only with their fans but the wider world in issues of contemporary import. I found it fascinating reading this book, despite not knowing who Tom York, Johnny Greenwood, Colin Greenwood, Ed O'Brien, or Philip Selway were. I found Mr. Rose's discussion of the themes Radiohead explores, such as disenfranchisement, apathy, the environment, terrorism, the apocalypse, and more, engaging. The book looks at the history of the band and its place in music history. Phil Rose has taught at several Canadian universities and is president of the Sylvan Tompkins Institute. He has authored several books, including Roger Waters and Pink Floyd, the concept albums, Radiohead and the Global Movement for Change, and Confronting Technopoly. This book is published by Roman and Littlefield and is part of their Tempo series. It looks at rock and popular music through the lens of social and cultural history. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Phil Rose. Dr. Rose, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Pretty good yourself.
Very good. Beautiful day here.
It's it's an all right day here in Vancouver.
Is it?
It's one of those. It's been great the whole week, and then yet last night it rained, and then this morning I think there's still some showers. So,
but sorry about your luck.
But it's still a great time in this country.
Yeah.
And wherever you are.
For sure.
Yeah. You're in Hamilton, and the connection that radio has with Canada, I guess Toronto, I guess, is probably the in that accident. How long ago was that now?
I believe that was 2012, if I'm not mistaken, because they were doing a tour. That show was, of course, canceled because of the tragic accident of the stage collapsing.
Right. And so does Radiohead still tour?
Yes. In fact, I saw them last summer here in Toronto. It was the first time they'd been back since the time of the accident. They'd been sort of avoiding Toronto and much of Canada, I think, after that time,
right.
Though not exclusively. But, I saw them both nights they played in Toronto, and it was quite notable because throughout the two nights they only played three songs in common. Otherwise, the sets were entirely different.
Mm.
So worth going to both shows, I thought.
Yeah. I started reading the book if you put a gun to my head, I couldn't tell you a Radiohead song. And then I realized I had fake plastic trees in my iPod, which I've had for years, and I've liked,
Right.
But someone said, "Well, have you heard Creep?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Well, what do you think of Tom York?" And I said, "Who's he?" So then I read your book, and it was fascinating to see how Radiohead came together, and what I enjoyed about the book. And I deliberately did this, not to listen to anything until I finished the book,
right.
Was to read about how you wrote about the certain albums and certain songs. Because I found it fascinating that just how close you listened to those things and how seriously you considered their work.
Right.
Because you do write so thoughtfully about what they mean. This is obviously music that you enjoy listening to. If you had to put together a playlist, say,
yeah,
what would you include?
Well, that's a bit of a jagged question because there is a value to, I think, taking the albums as a whole together.
Mm.
So when it comes to the actual studio albums, I would likely recommend that people ultimately, hear them. But, if it was a complete novice person that was maybe not interested so much in album, as a medium,
yeah.
Then let's see, I would I guess I would include Creep because it at least lets you know. And did you, by the way, after you did you get a chance to listen to Creep? And
I did.
Did you know it? Did you know it already then?
No.
You didn't?
I was surprised at how I hadn't heard this thing before.
Oh, that is very interesting.
And then I looked on the Spotify, and you know when you type in an artist, it puts up, I guess, I don't know, the top five or the top ten things that people are listening to, and then you can see the number in the hundreds of millions, how
right.
many times this thing has been streamed. And so that's at the top of the list, obviously.
Right.
And
so
that's something as you just said, a novice should listen to, right?
Yeah, I think they should, have that as an example of knowing what kind of paved the way for us knowing the band in general and for allowing them to have the kind of career that they have been able to have after the success that song garnered for them. And that's despite their own feelings about the song. They actually stopped performing it, I think, pretty much with their 1997 tours and whatnot. And so it was quite interesting because then they didn't play it for a number of years until I think their homecoming at an Oxford concert in 2001 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you'd include that just so people would know. You would certainly, it depends on how, of course, you'd want to share the tracks across the albums and whatnot. But I'd probably include something else from their first album. But you, moving on to the second album, you mentioned Fake Plastic Trees as a significant number.
Mm-hmm.
As I go on to think about this, I can see how actually difficult it would be and painful in terms of excluding some songs through others. So I might just revert to my original answer and suggest that people should try and consume the albums as totalities, because for me, really, the themes are the most resonant aspects. In large part of their work, and the themes are most clearly discernible when I think you listen to them in the context that they were intended to be heard.
Yeah, then that's what struck me as I was reading the book, and how thoughtfully they put together the albums in terms of these themes that at that time, at any specific time, that these are the things that they wanted to talk about.
That's right, and you probably may remember, a quotation from the bass player who talked about they had meetings for hours, agonizing meetings, just to determine the order of the songs as they appear on the album.
Yeah, so
there's a lot of consideration that goes into it, you know.
Now, they came together, that'd be 35 years ago now, almost, right?
Yeah, remarkable.
And so, what sort of backgrounds did these guys have?
Well, I think they were all pretty comfortably middle class, upper middle class even. They attended private schools in their beginnings. Interestingly enough, and something I do tease out a little bit in the book, is the fact that they were attending, then they met at this sort of high school, which was a Church of England, Anglican church.
Uh-huh.
Private institution. So that kind of illustrates they come from a sort of privileged background, I think, to be able to attend a school like that. And then they all, with the exception of one of them, went on to do university degrees following their completion of that school.
And what have you found out in terms of where they come from in their background as to how they feel about the world around them? Because for a lot of people, Radiohead exemplifies or vocalizes for a generation sort of disenfranchisement that people feel about what was happening in not only 35 years ago, but since.
Yeah, no, I would certainly, I mean, that's one of the themes for me which has most resonated over time, ever since I, discerned that's what they were communicating, particularly in OK Computer. And certainly I'd say it probably speaks to people who feel that way, that have concern about being able to, fulfill the promise of a democratic society through influencing their governments in meaningful ways. when that threatens to not be achievable, that just sort of leads to, I think, the sense of disenfranchisement, disillusionment, alienation, which much of which gets expressed in their music and lyrics.
And it's I was going to say it's a wonderful time capsule when you look back at certain songs. But then, you know, the problems that one faced, say, 30, 25, 20 years ago, I mean, they're the same ones, aren't they, really?
They are, yeah. We sort of have emerged into a cultural situation where, particularly we're learning every day more and more how our interactions with the environment and the climate has been, harming even our potential for survival.
Mm.
And so, yeah, we live in times where we are afflicted with the awareness that we could actually lead to our own destruction. And so I think that that's certainly a tenet that runs throughout most of their work, including, also the kind of portrayal that a lot of the time we're not paying enough attention to not only things like that, but to what's happening, in our politics and in our business, etc.
It also struck me as in a lot of their work, they seemed ahead of their time. And some critics might have even looked at them at times as paranoid.
Sure. You could get that sort of admission through the song Paranoid Android, in fact, where he portrays himself and borrows from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy there, the character Marvin, the paranoid android, who is sort of the background of that song. But as I would perhaps suggest that even, that character is probably resonates with Tom York as well, but also I know it resonated with me at one time, in terms of just being, even afraid to speak out about issues that are of public concern, and that it takes a lot of guts to do that. And when you hear about efforts of the 1970s, where the U.S. was backing South American governments in trying to purge activists, knowingly doing so, then you can get concerned about trying to raise a stink about things.
And that's the thing that Radiohead has done, not only as performers, but they do realize that they have an audience, and that they can use this platform that they have to raise awareness. And
that's correct, yeah.
And I think that's something that has struck to, that has, I guess, affected their fans, their devotees, in terms of why they like them so much, not just for the music, say, right?
Right. And you reminded me of the Canadian journalist Naomi Klein, who talked about how after Radiohead had sort of raised the profile of her book by talking about it and giving out copies to people in the audience, she would see people coming to her talks all the time in Radiohead shirts, and so she'd be meeting their fans all the time.
Yeah.
And so certainly they've animated those kinds of concerns in people, or at least reinforced people's own concerns and feelings and their interests in attending to those kinds of concerns.
Another part of the book that I found interesting is when you talk about the relationship between art and commerce. They know how they're consumed by their audience and how. And that's something that they've wanted to, say, look at through their work, right?
Yeah, that I try and illustrate in the book, too, what a struggle that was, particularly in the sort of first half of their career and the various levels of success that they were attaining. It represented for them pretty, and particularly for Tom York, who I think is mostly vocalizing these concerns. You'll have to apologize for my dog there. Something's
probably
how excited
to,
are
the probably something you said.
Maybe. Maybe. They had difficulty in terms of adapting to those sort of changes that accompanied their increasing success. And they did come through that, I think, quite successfully in the end, not without some pain. But I think they've reached a pretty healthy perspective in the sort of current time, because a couple of them have sort of made the comment that, they don't feel any kind of imperative that they need to do something right away, that they're very conscious that they're not, as I think Tom York put it, feeding the machine, getting caught up in the product that they have managed to build, and only, trying to maintain it as an outlet for when they think they have something to say as a group together.
And I guess that's also key in remaining relevant. I mean, a lot of artists might think that they have to come up with something new regularly.
Right.
But at the same time, Radiohead can remain relevant doing things the way they want to do things.
That's right. I think especially since, they left EMI just prior to their release of In Rainbows, their self-release, the first self-release. I think that has cut a lot of senses of obligation to outside parties. So I don't think they quite feel the same kind of pressures that were probably exerted on them, particularly early on by the record company.
Were you always a fan?
No, I. In fact, we were talking about the song "Creep" there, and that would be the first time I would have heard them. And I heard that because a guitar student of mine, I was teaching guitar at the time, and he had come in with that song because he wanted to learn it. So we were learning it, but it didn't really necessarily grab me or suit my fancy. And partially, it was because some of the motivations I was wondering about with the student, and in any case, it kind of got a bad sort of flavor for me. And I mean, I it's a song I perform myself musically, and in fact I'm going to play an all Radiohead night at a book release here in Hamilton, but that's a song I've never really played myself, partially because of the way the band has felt about it, but it's not one I've ever felt the need to play. But that's when I first heard of them, and then I just heard of them, was introduced to them more properly by a fellow musician who I worked with for a number of years, and who introduced me to the Benz and OK Computer. And at that point, I, had those albums on and listening to them and getting to know, the great quality of their work.
What have they been like to listen to in terms of, and to take the perspective of seeing how they've matured, say, because one does get older, I hope, in 35 years. Do you see that in their work, and not only in the things that they're performing about or they're talking about, but just in terms of musicianship? I mean, has there been a sense of maturity in terms of how they play?
Yeah. Although I think none of them would claim to be, necessarily agile musicians, necessarily. I think they kind of have more of a sense of working, as producers together and as collective kind of composers. But that... through that way, I think it does demonstrate, the maturity. So, for instance, after, they'd done those two early albums, which were quite successful and remain successful, they really changed their style with Kid A. And what they were doing, to some extent, was they had a lot of influence coming from particular jazz artists like Charles Mingus, but even before then, Miles Davis had been an influence, even on OK Computer. And so through time, a lot of their influences outside of popular music, a lot of contemporary, or at least 20th century composers, were very influential on the Johnny Greenwood, the guitarist, and so employing you know, that influence in his string arrangements for particular tracks, and in you know, usage of musical instruments like the Ohms Martineau, which is a sort of a 20th century electronic instrument that was another thing that they picked up. So yeah, there's always been this kind of accumulation of influence, and then applying that influence as well, I think, in their work.
Now, they've always talked about the future, and you know, people of that generation, I'm 37, so this is a generation before me, if you will, have always looked at the future with fear, anxiety, obviously, and I think we all do, but their view of the future in particular, that hasn't really changed in terms of just how perilous they think it'll turn out.
No. I think that's been present at least since, you know, the song Street Spirit on the Bends. You know, there's just been this kind of awareness and concern about, I'm just trying to think of her name. I think it was it Jane Jacobs that... gave a talk called Dark Age Ahead,
right,
or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah,
right?
she was an American who went to Toronto.
That's correct.
Fact, yeah.
Yeah, and anyways, so that kind of sense of how easy it can be for a civilization to collapse, and the fear of that occurring has been omnipresent throughout their whole productivity, I think. And to some extent, I think it is because we do live, and I suggest this in the book, that we do live in a very apocalyptic time, in the sense of an apocalypse being kind of like the revealing of whether or not we're going to be up for the job of survival. And that is primarily through our violence, potentially towards each other, in terms of a nuclear age of weaponry, and then not to mention automated sort of soldiery, etc.
Yeah.
But also in terms of the violence we're conflicting on the planet. So because that sense of survival is more in our face than it ever has been, I suggest that is kind of what makes our times especially apocalyptic.
Now, they were named to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, prizes aside and that institution aside, with all the politics involved in who gets picked and the sort, that's still a significant achievement, and I guess an acknowledgement that they have had a significant impact on music itself.
Yeah. I think that certainly is. I would even suggest that a larger one that's not quite connected in the same way to necessarily, you know, popular culture was OK Computer being named to the, you know, Library of Congress's archived recordings.
Yeah.
I mean, it was pretty interesting because that album came out in 1997. And these are, of course, when the Library of Congress does that, it's sort of registering
old stuff.
Things
yeah.
that people think are deemed to have cultural relevance. And what I was going to mention was that it was inducted the same year as the Doors' first album.
Mm.
But, of course, the Doors' first album came three decades before.
Right. Yeah.
So that was just, I think, kind of telling in terms of perhaps their the recognition of what they've done.
Your book is part of a series that your publisher has put out called Tempo.
That's right.
I was looking at at the front of the book where they have a listing. I mean, there's so many other books that I want to read in this series. But the thing that I enjoyed about reading your book, and obviously reading it not knowing the music that you're writing about, was how it must have been fun to do, was it?
Yeah, it was fun to do. In fact, I learned a number of things in the process of doing it, as you usually do when you're working on something like that. But it forced me to sit down and have that closer listen and closer attendance to that you mentioned before to some of the albums that I hadn't already done that with in my previous work on the band. So in the process of doing that, I learned a lot about some of the albums in terms of their themes and potential meanings. And so that certainly was quite enjoyable, and especially because most of the time I was writing, I think it was last summer, which afforded some nice days to work outside and enjoy some sunshine at the same time.
By the way, we started the conversation talking about watching them live, as you did recently. Mm-hmm. When you listen to music, especially when you're alone, is there a difference when you have it, say, coming from a speaker or if it's from those things that we put in our ears?
Yeah, I would say there is a sort of difference. For starters, the things we put in our ears, depending on what you're referring to, might mean that we're mobile.
Mm-hmm.
And we can take it with us and, create a sort of musical soundtrack to our day as we, go from place to place, perhaps. If we're, sitting at a, in front of a speaker alone, as you described, or even with, headphones at home, your disposition is possibly more one that's less distracted by things around you and perhaps a closer attendance, but that, of course, always depends on individuals themselves.
And then the experience of listening to them live with a bunch of other people. I mean, that must add something to the music that you've been listening to for a long time altogether, right?
Yeah. I think it's interesting because I mentioned how they had done these two entirely different sets when I saw them last summer, I believe it was. And one of the things that indicates, so for instance, Roger Waters, who is another artist in Pink Floyd that I, have written about, but mm-hmm. an artist like Roger Waters would not do that, essentially because his stage show is so elaborate and so staged and coordinated that that kind of freedom doesn't exist for him. I've often thought to some extent that Radiohead's live presentations lacked a little bit of some kinds of those same sort of things that, Roger Waters or Pink Floyd might do.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you do appreciate the freshness which must exist for them in being able to, as I'm to understand, to basically make their set lists the days of their performances, and that kind of freedom of the performance. So I think that would, be one of the things I'd isolate as exciting about seeing Radiohead in performance.
Phil, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you about this book that I found it as I finished it, enjoying a great deal. Congratulations on it and good luck with it.
Thank you very much, and I really quite appreciate that, especially because to me I would think it must be a much more challenging read when you don't know the band and what the songs that are being written about, but you give me hope that it might be interesting even to someone that doesn't know the band.
It was fun for me. I mean, and then to go and then look these things up and then listen to them as I was reading. Usually I did it afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just fascinating really for me, it was to discover this music.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very excited to hear that, and so happy to talk to you today.
The book is called Radiohead, Music for a Global Future. It is published by Roman and Littlefield. That's part of their Tempo series. Phil Rose joined me on the line from Hamilton in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.